famous hadith Islamic saying is, Allah is beautiful and loves beauty. Beauty has always been, therefore, very important to Muslims and develops in the virtual arts such as architecture, calligraphy, painting, textile, metalwork, and ceramists were encouraged. On the continuation of Iran Radio, we'll listen to this part. We start off this hour's programs with our news bulletin. That will be followed by the Ocean of Dua. The program explains supplications and prayers taken from various books such as Mafatihul Junan and Kamilu Ziyarat. And we round up this hour with our varied radio productions feature.
This is the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran.
The headlines. President Pezeshkian says allegations about Iran's nuclear program being over are an illusion, stressing that uranium enrichment will continue within the framework of international law. Israeli forces killed more than 38 aid seekers within a single day in Gaza as the regime's genocidal war rages on across the besieged territory. And the UN chief describes the situation in Gaza as a horror show, with a level of death and destruction without parallel in recent times. Hello and welcome, everybody. A top story. The Iranian president says allegations about Iran's nuclear program being over are an illusion, stressing that uranium enrichment will continue within the framework of international laws. In an interview with Al Jazeera Network, Masoud Pezeshkian said Iran's nuclear capabilities lie in the minds of its scientists, not just in facilities. He reiterated that Iran does not seek to develop nuclear weapons, describing it as the country's political, religious, humanitarian, and strategic stance. Pezeshkian said during the 12-day U.S.-Israeli imposed war, Israel sought to eliminate Iran through chaos and targeting the system, but it failed. He stressed that it was Iran's ability to strike deep inside the occupied territories that forced Israel to seek a ceasefire. Pezeshkian emphasized that Iran is prepared for any military action and its forces are ready to strike deep inside Israel. Again, he noted that any future negotiations must be based on a win-win approach. As Iran, we will not accept threats or dictates. A ceremony titled Forever Iran has been held in Tehran's iconic Vahdat Hall, honoring artists, poets, writers, and journalists who lost their lives during the 12-day Israeli aggression. Fatima Masumi has the details.
A tribute to martyrs who held pens, brushes, and camera lenses, not guns, in their hands. They were not soldiers in uniform, but defenders of Iranian identity. Artists, poets, journalists, Quran reciters, and memorizers, and members of mosque cultural centers, innocently martyred during the 12-day Israeli aggression. High-ranking officials, cultural figures, artists, and journalists gathered in Tehran's Vahdat Hall to honor their memory.
The Iranian people will never yield to force or oppression. The occupying Zionist regime continues to violate international law with impunity, invading neighboring countries, committing assassinations, and carrying out acts of aggression without restraint. The sensitive hearts of the artists, journalists, and poets feel these atrocities more deeply than most.
The ceremony is filled with heartfelt tributes, displays of the martyrs' art and live performances, all echoing a single message. Though they are gone, they will not be forgotten. It's a message that resonates with Iranians from all walks of life, uniting them in the face of foreign aggression.
The widespread solidarity of the people during these 12 days showed how individuals from different backgrounds, beliefs, and ethnicities all united around the idea of Iran and spoke with one voice. From the very beginning of the crisis, the cultural, artistic, and media communities were fully engaged.
During the 12-day Israeli aggression, Iranians found strength and solidarity. The ceremony is a reminder that even the deepest tragedies can be transformed into collective resilience.
We are all Iranians. When Iran is in pain, we feel that pain too. When Iran faces a problem, it concerns us as well. We are here at this ceremony with a deep sense of affection and devotion to our homeland.
We lost, unfortunately, a lot of our artists in these recent events, but it shows that the nation are united, and we are celebrating the unification of our nation.
The families of the fallen were also honored, many clutching portraits of their loved ones, a young photojournalist, a Quran memorizer, a provincial poet. Their legacy now lives on in the hearts of a nation.
The martyrs honored in this ceremony were not soldiers on the battlefield or military personnel. They were artists, writers, photographers, and poets innocently killed. Their legacy, however, endures through every brushstroke, poem, and melody as Iran pays tribute to voices silenced but destined never to be forgotten. Fateh Masumi, Tehran.
Death and destruction continue to ravage Gaza nearly 22 months into Israel's genocidal war against Palestinians in the blockaded territory. In one of the latest attacks, 7 civilians were killed after Israeli bombing west of the radio and television building in Tel al-Hawa neighborhood of Gaza City. Earlier, over a dozen people, including children, were killed after Israeli warplanes bombed a residential building northwest of Gaza City. Multiple fatalities were reported after a separate strike targeted an apartment building in the same area. An Israeli strike targeting tents of displaced Palestinians west of Gaza City was also deadly, with several fatalities. Israeli forces also opened fire on Palestinians seeking aid in different parts of Gaza, killing more than 30 hungry civilians. The U.S.-Israeli genocide, which began in October 2023, has so far killed more than 59,100 Palestinians, leaving over 142,500 others injured. Most of the victims are women and children. Our Gaza correspondent Moti Abu Mosabe joined us early with more details on the latest Israeli attacks across the besieged territory. Here's what he had to say.
As you know, those attacks are still maintained with the same brutality since the very beginning of this genocidal war till this moment, and particularly when it comes to Deir al-Balah city, which is still, as you know, subjected to this ongoing military offensive that targets the southern outskirts of Deir al-Balah city. Every moment we can hear several bombardments booming, and those areas targeting more residential buildings in addition to the artillery strikes, which are still ongoing and abated. The current situation is still very tragic and precarious for the Palestinian families in Deir al-Balah city amid the rising fears and concerns among the people here that the Israeli occupation forces are going to expand the attacks to include and target more residential areas in Deir al-Balah, and which is absolutely overwhelmed with hundreds of thousands of the Palestinian displaced who are still taking shelter in Deir al-Balah city, and they are still exposed to more brutal air strikes and attacks. And to be honest, over the past couple of hours, the Israeli warplanes launched several air strikes targeting more residential buildings. We are talking about at least 30 Palestinian civilians, 30 Palestinian residential buildings have been targeted and destroyed in Deir al-Balah city alone in less than 48 hours since the onset of this brutal ground offensive that targets Deir al-Balah city.
The UN Secretary General has issued a serious warning about the rapidly deteriorating humanitarian situation in Gaza. Antonio Guterres described the war-torn territory's current condition as a horror show marked by mass devastation and starvation.
We need look no further than the horror show in Gaza, with a level of death and destruction without parallel in recent times. Malnourishment is soaring. Starvation is knocking on every door. And now we are seeing the last gasp of a humanitarian system built on humanitarian principles. This system is being denied the conditions to function, denied the space to deliver, denied the safety to save lives. Around
the world. Addressing the UN Security Council, Guterres condemned Israel's military aggression against Gaza and its continued restrictions on the delivery of humanitarian aid, including food to its people. He said the situation in Gaza reflects a broader failure to uphold international obligations across the globe. Guterres warned that hunger and displacement in Gaza have reached record levels as the conflict intensifies and international law is repeatedly violated. He also denounced recent Israeli attacks on UN facilities, emphasizing that those premises must be protected under international humanitarian law. He urged all UN member states to uphold international law and reaffirm their commitment to peace. Author and journalist Sakina Daoud joined us earlier. She said a global uprising is crucial to pressure governments into taking meaningful action to stop the genocide in Gaza.
Sanctions in all sorts of manners. You know, I am astounded, really, that people are just around the world are, you know, sitting back and watching these kind of images. And, you know, there is a lot of power that people have. And this is something that, unfortunately, around the world, people don't seem to understand. For example, you know, I talk to women in Gaza on my show, and I find it so disturbing, you know, the images that are coming out. One of the things that women after women tell me is that the Arab and Muslim world is sending us shrouds continuously. That is all the help they are providing us. And shrouds are not needed for people who are martyred. And they do not need a shroud. They can be buried without it. They are not bothered about sending food, about sending medicines, about even making statements. So what are all these ordinary people in those countries doing? We are aware of the fact that, you know, they have dictatorial governments and it is difficult. But if they are not going to rise up, if they are not going to demand something of their governments, then when will they ever speak up? It really is very distressing to see not only that the people are starving there, but that the rest of the world is going about, you know, their daily lives as if there is nothing serious happening. It just boggles the mind, and it is really disturbing. It is one of the lowest points, I believe, in human history.
The leader of the Hezbollah movement has condemned the global silence on Israel's crimes in Gaza, calling for actual measures to stop the massacre of Palestinians in the besieged territory. Sheikh Naim Qassem's remarks followed a joint statement by 25 countries, including some European states, calling for an immediate end to the Gaza war. Qassem said the call does not absolve those countries of their responsibility regarding what is happening in Gaza. He said such positions must be translated into actual measures to stop such crimes by imposing sanctions on Israel, isolating and prosecuting the regime, and stopping all forms of dealings with it. The Hezbollah chief also called on the Arab and Islamic countries to shoulder their responsibility, stop normalization with Israel, close the regime's embassies, and cut relations with Tel Aviv. Qassem described the U.S.-Israeli atrocities in Gaza as excessive savagery, genocide, and starvation, which have exceeded all human and moral standards. Iran's foreign ministry has strongly condemned the continued killing of Palestinians in Gaza by Israel and the regime's strict ban on delivery of food, water, medicine, and other basic necessities to its defenseless people. The ministry also expressed deep concern over the worsening humanitarian catastrophe caused by the horrific crimes of the Israeli regime in the besieged Gaza Strip. It called for urgent, effective, and decisive measures by international community and regional countries to stop the genocide in Gaza and alleviate the suffering of the oppressed Palestinian people. The ministry also criticized the UN Security Council for failing to fulfill its legal responsibilities regarding the aggression and crimes of the occupying regime. It slammed the all-out support of the West, especially the U.S., for supporting Israel and saying it has not only granted the regime impunity, but also paved the way for even more severe crimes in Gaza. The Palestinian Islamic Jihad says the fate of an Israeli captive held in Gaza remains unknown following the regime's attack on the area where he was being held. A spokesman for the group's military wing, the Al-Quds Brigades, said contact with the security group holding the captive, Ram Breslovsky, has been lost since Monday. Abu Hamza held Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu and his extremist regime responsible for deliberately neglecting the captive's plight. He said the regime is doing everything possible to ensure captives are returned in coffins. Breslovsky's family said Israeli officials have refused to meet with them or provide updates on his condition. Meanwhile, Israel's opposition leader Yair Golan denounced the regime's handling of the captive crisis as a nightmare for their families. The UK public broadcaster, the BBC, continues to face outrage over its censorship of the Gaza genocide. Critics are using different mediums to raise awareness about the BBC bias and reignite fierce debate about Western media complicity in the ongoing genocide.
An image that speaks a thousand words. In the London Underground, an advert exposing the complicity of British media in the Gaza genocide. One of the topics up for discussion at a gathering in this Palestinian cultural center, with the BBC and other mainstream media outlets accused of providing lopsided coverage of Israel's genocidal war on the coastal enclave.
It comes across to me as having to speak on behalf of the state, whichever the state might be. And therefore, in doing that, it can't not say what is happening, but it says what's happening in such bland, neutral terms that it doesn't make any sense to the reality on the ground.
A reality highlighted by the Center for Media Monitoring in its recently published report detailing the deep-seated anti-Palestinian bias in the BBC's coverage of the Gaza genocide.
When the Center for Media Monitoring shows conclusively that they interview X amount more Israelis than they do Palestinians, they two-size the genocide by continuously showing the Israeli rebuttal. This is proof that they are not indeed impartial. And actually, this is a breach of their royal charter. This is what gives them the privilege to receive the UK license fee payers' money. So the fact that they are in continuous breach of that, yet nothing is happening, completely breaks down that facade.
I've heard you.
A facade also challenged by the likes of Egyptian journalist Rahma Zain. In her work and her fiery exchange with a CNN reporter in the region in the early days of Israel's genocidal war on Gaza.
What media is doing, it's gone off from telling the news to hiding the news. We're seeing people being starved to death, and the magnitude of that is not represented by media, purposely to not only sedate the people, but to further dehumanize us in the region. And by dehumanizing us, they can get away with brutalizing us.
Examples of what critics call a war on truth, the BBC's decision earlier this year to drop a documentary depicting unspeakable horrors faced by Gaza's medical workers. And before that, the shelving of another Gaza expose narrated by a 13-year-old Palestinian boy. Here at Palestine House, a group of journalists and activists have gathered not only to lament and to grieve Britain's mainstream media's complicity and silence, but also to break it. If the media won't carry the truth they maintain, the people must. Saipur is up, London.
Columbia University in the U.S. has imposed punitive measures on dozens of students over their participation in pro-Palestine protests amid the genocide in Gaza. The university has said in a statement that the punishment is related to, quote, disruption of Butler Library in May this year and an encampment during alumni weekend in 2024. According to a student group of the university, nearly 80 students have been expelled or suspended for up to 3 years. The group named Columbia University Apartheid Divest said the punitive measures hugely exceed the precedent and is politically motivated. The pro-Palestine encampments at Columbia University in 2024 helped ignite a global movement against Israel's genocidal war in Gaza. Israeli forces have killed a Palestinian teenager during a military incursion into the town of Qabatiya near the occupied West Bank city of Jenin. According to local sources, 16-year-old Ibrahim Majid Ali Nasr succumbed to a serious injury to his chest after he was shot by Israeli soldiers' live ammunition. The new fatality increased to 43, the number of Palestinians killed during the regime's ongoing military aggression against Jenin governorate. Israeli forces and settlers have intensified crackdown on Palestinians in the West Bank since the outbreak of the regime's genocidal war on Gaza in October 2023. Since that time, nearly 1,000 Palestinians have been killed and around 7,000 others injured across the occupied territory. Well, that's a wrap for now.
Can we not see?
planets look like diamonds in the sky, and everything on earth was created for you and I. Can we not see man is merely all again. Do we think it's all again? Do we think it's all again? Do we think it's all again?
Ocean of Dua.
بسم الله الرحمن الرحيم. الحمد لله رب العالمين، ثم الصلاة والسلام على محمد وآله الطاهرين. In the name of Allah, the Most Beneficent, the Most Merciful. I am Sayyid Muhammad Hassan Mudarrisi, and we're going to be with you in this edition of the program, The Ocean of Dua. In this edition, we will try to talk about dozens of supplications from the Holy Quran that can be recited during the Qunut in everyday prayers and Salat. So stay with us. Dear brothers and sisters, we can also recite this verse, 126th verse of Surah Al-A'raf, رَبَّنَا أَفْرِغَ عَلَيْنَا صَبْرًا وَتَوَفَّنَا مُسْلِمِينَ. O our Lord, pour out on us patience and make us die as those who have submitted to you. Dear listeners, if hardship, poverty and discomfort and any kind of hardship come in your life, you as a faithful servant of Allah must recite this dua to have patience and self-control to remain firm on the right path and face the misfortunes boldly without ever showing any action that has been prohibited, so that you may leave this world as a true Muslim submitting to the will of Allah. That's what this verse is trying to tell. The verse is implying that if we have patience by the side of the Almighty Allah, we have the ability to die as a true Muslim, to die as a true believer, to die as the one who has submitted to the Almighty Allah. رَبَّنَا آتِنَا فِي الدُّنْيَا حَسَنَةً وَفِي الْآخِرَةِ حَسَنَةً وَقِنَا عَذَابَ النَّارِ وَقِنَا عَذَابَ النَّارِ. And one more point, dear listeners, regarding this verse. This verse was recited by some people. A group of master magicians, on the invitation of Pharaoh, came to show their superiority over Moses, or Musa, because Pharaoh wrongly thought that Moses was also a magician. The magicians threw a few ropes on the floor, and they took the shape of snakes. Moses put the staff he was holding in his hand on the ground, and the staff changed into a python. After it was changed into a python, it swallowed up all the snakes and ropes. Pharaoh got angry and threatened to kill them. Then these magicians came to know that Moses was not a magician, but a prophet of Allah. And when they saw this miracle of Allah, they laughed at Pharaoh and recited this dua, رَبَّنَا أَفْرِغَ عَلَيْنَا صَبْرًا وَتَوَفَّنَا مُسْلِمِينَ. O our Lord, pour out down on us patience and make us die as those who have submitted to you. May the Almighty Allah also make us die as those who have submitted to him. The next verse that we're trying to talk about in this program is this verse, 151st one of this very chapter. رَبِّ اغْفِرْ لِي وَلِي أَخِي وَأَدْخِلْنَا فِي رَحْمَتِكَ وَأَنْتَ أَرْحَمُ الرَّاحِمِينَ. O Allah, forgive me and my brother and admit us to your mercy. You are the most merciful of the merciful. A true faithful must always recite this dua to seek mercy of the merciful Lord, particularly when he is in the middle of the unmanageable difficulties of his life. So when we face hardships, discomforts, and even poverty, we can recite this dua.
Why do we make supplication? And why do we call out to Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala? Is it because God is not aware of our needs? God is Al-Alim. He knows all of our needs. Is it because God needs convincing? God is known as Al-Jawad. He is the source of generosity. Then why am I making dua to Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala? The dua is a journey of realizations. When a person goes to the ocean and he takes with him a bucket that can carry 4 liters of water, the ocean is infinite. In as much as your vessel is large, that is the amount of water that the ocean will give you. And therefore, our goal is to expand our capacity. Rumi has a very beautiful poem. He says, Har khujo mushkil javab onjo ravad. Wherever there is a problem, that is where the answer will come. Har khujo kashti of Banjarabad. Wherever there is a vessel, that's where the water will come. Ab kamju tishnagi avar bedast. Don't go seeking for water. Instead, create the thirst within you. Ta bejushad ab az bala va past. So that the water may burst forth from above and from below you. Experience that realization that you need God, and the mercy of God will come towards you. Paradise, thank you Allah, now that we're here, feeling so good about all the things that we went through, knowing that God is pleased with us too. It's not a dream, this is so true, and we know we'll be here forever. Feeling is indescribable, knowing that this is our reward.
The ocean of dua.
Regarding this verse, dear listeners, to receive the Torah, Moses climbed the mountain of Tur and observed fast for 30 days, as directed by the Almighty Allah. Moses noticed that on account of fasting, his mouth was stinking, so he thought it was improper to pronounce the glory of Allah with a stinking mouth, and he brushed his teeth. This was considered an act of disobedience, and he was required to observe fast for 10 more days. After 40 days, Moses came back to his people with Torah, but he found his people worshipping the false god of the magician, Samiri. Upon seeing this, Moses became angry and criticized his brother Aaron, Harun, who was acting as his lieutenant, some kind of a representative in his 40 days of absence. Aaron explained that he tried his best to keep them on the right path and warned these people against the tricks of the magician, but they paid no attention to his advice, so his brother Moses should have not included him in the group of the unjust followers. Moses, upon hearing the explanation of Harun, recited this dua, رَبِّغْفِرْ لِي وَلِأَخِي. O Allah, forgive me and my brother, وَأَدْخِلْنَا فِي رَحْمَتِكَ, and admit us to your mercy, وَأَنْتَ أَرْحَمُ الرَّاحِمِينَ. You are the most merciful of the merciful. It is highly recommended to read this dua in Qunut, in all prayers, dear listeners. May the Almighty Allah set us among the guided ones and the people of the straight path. Wassalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh.
Thank you, dear listeners of IRIB English, for listening to us. If you have any question regarding our programs, feel free to email us at englishradio@irib.ir. Also visit our website at parstoday.com. Until the next program, take care and goodbye.
Life is full of choices. Choose the best option. Visit us at parstoday.ir/en. IRIB English Radio.
There are journalists who excel at presenting intricate global affairs with clarity, offering fresh perspectives on the stories that shape our world. Their investigative work often challenges dominant narratives, opening doors to deeper understanding. My guest today is one such individual who has dedicated her career to uncovering the truth behind complex international issues, producing thought-provoking and influential reports that resonate with audiences worldwide. Welcome to SORP. I am Bahman Roy, your host. Anya Parampil is an American journalist known for her work with RT America and The Gray Zone. She has gained recognition for her investigative reporting and coverage of international affairs. Her journalism often focuses on geopolitical issues and has brought her into the spotlight for interviews and collaborations with prominent figures.
The world war that we are going to experience, or that we are experiencing in our generation, is not this of the same nature as the world wars past. There's not trenches. The nature of the war is different. The battle is different. It's a hybrid war. They have economic sanctions that they levy as part of this war. They wage a media war through your mind now, not just on the television, but through social media as well. And there's a proxy war. There's a covert aspect, which is what we're seeing play out in Ukraine. And when we are clear about those objectives and about the stakes, it's not so hard to put away our differences and to come together and rage against the war machine. So thank you all for doing it. Thank you for letting me speak. Thank you to Nick and Angela once again. And no more war!
Ms. Anya Parampil, it's so good to have you on SORP.
Thank you for having me. It's wonderful to be in Tehran and to explore this country.
Lovely to hear that. I was really impressed with the fact that you wrote a book on the Venezuelan crisis and the failed coup. And, of course, I would love to have a copy of that if you can arrange that. Tell me about the situation in Gaza now and the role of international institutions and organizations. Of course, what we are witnessing is a total failure of the international system. It is broken. It cannot everybody individually, individual governments are coming out and saying that this is horrendous, what is happening in Gaza, especially with the blockade of aid. Mm-hmm. Right now, more than 2 months, we are into that. But how can we fix that? How can the world fix that?
Gaza does represent the ultimate failure of this world, that even when we talk about the economic sense, this is the world order that has been established since World War II, when we were told never again, that this was all established to prevent what happened in Gaza. I think that this live-streamed Holocaust, which is worse than anything humans have lived through in history, at the time World War II or previous conflicts, we never were waking up every day while it was happening to see it, to see the children, to see the families torn apart. And so, in fact, many people didn't know in the past when these things were going on. So there was more of a, looking back on history, there was at least a reason or excuse that it could have gone on. Now there's no excuse. People know, they saw. And so we have to question, why was this allowed to happen? Well, institutions like the UN, I think that I've defended in the past, or I see as valuable as a place for the world to come together and speak, and based on the principles of territorial integrity, political independence, and sovereignty, great. But then we remember the UN was the institution that established Israel in the first place. So those principles were never on the table for Palestinians. And now we see that when it comes to this concept of never again, the UN completely failed. They can talk all day, but if the UN were truly going to serve its purpose, there should have been a force to stop the Israelis immediately after we saw a few weeks of the devastation in Gaza. And so it's clear that the UN and other institutions that were established at that time are there to support this world order. And I think that when we talk about a rising multipolar world or the inevitability, what is that inevitability based on? To me, it's that all people want to be sovereign. They want to be independent. They don't want to be living under the boot of an imperial power. And that, of course, applies most of all to the Palestinians. That is their only crime, is simply wanting their land and their homes. And so they are the distillation of this crisis of the New World Order, or the rules-based international order that you hear Blinken and the liberal establishment speak of. And so for the world now to see, I think it's going to be the nail in the coffin of that system. And Israel, I think, probably wrote its own death certificate. Again, we don't know how long it will take, but I do think that ultimately Israel can't recover from this, just the same way that the international system cannot recover from this.
And what will be the change that will come after that? Because, of course, we are all seeing the signs here, and the people, when I talk to our reporters on the ground in Gaza, they're all saying that, well, what ICJ is doing is impressive, but nobody even cares here anymore. Everybody right. wants meaningful action. So how do you think this meaningful action will come?
Unfortunately, the blow of Syria, for example, and the destruction of other countries that would have been part of the resistance over the last 20 years has contributed to a feeling that there's no one. Now you have Trump there's Iran, of course, because of this dynamic now in its own conflict with the United States. So when Trump comes to the Middle East, unfortunately, he gives this speech that in some ways I thought was excellent, talking about neocons having wrecked more countries than they've built and intervening in complex situations that they didn't understand. Then he said, the people of the region built this region, and that is what is a beautiful thing. But he's talking about these fake Gulf states, Saudi Arabia, the UAE, Qatar. These are not the people of the region. These are not they're kind of all of an invented people, especially when you look at the Gulf states. So he's not talking about the Arabs and the Iranians, who actually have centuries of civilization and history and a record of building their own region. I wish that that's what he was talking about. But so there's this tension, I think, between, yes, those states and Iran, obviously. But if Israel can wane in its influence, I do see that there's hope that ultimately that even these countries can work together with Iran. In the multipolar world, for a while, it means that there's more instability because you have countries rising up with their own agenda and power that can't be cut down the way that they may have in the past by
like
a strong
tectonic plates.
Exactly. The Pakistan in India is a good example of a place that you might see more tension in this multipolar world because both of those countries are going to assert themselves. Though for now the U.S. was able to say, okay, we're going to cut you off from trade. You better put a stop to this. And they cooled off. There's going to definitely be growing pains. But ultimately, I hope that there will be a stabilization where there's not just one hegemon, but I think the United States will always be a strong player on the international stage, China, Russia, India, and then there will be another wave of countries that are also influential, Iran, Turkey, Venezuela, Mexico, Algeria, South Africa, Egypt, the countries that are rising in BRICS for their importance. And once we go through those growing pains, I hope there will be more stability. And I hope the U.S. decides to just participate in that world as equals rather than try to undermine it, because it's not going to work out for anyone if we continue down that path.
Right. And I want to focus a little bit now on the U.S.-Israeli relationship, because even mainstream media are saying nowadays, as we speak now in May 2025, they're saying that there is a break and between the U.S. and Israel, especially over the Iran issue. Do you think that is true, or is it just mind games?
I think that it has to be true to a degree. If I'm in the position of Donald Trump, and what we know about Trump is that even maybe just from a narcissistic perspective, he would like to be remembered in history as a positive figure. He would like to be remembered as a deal maker. Yeah. I don't think he would like to be remembered as the one who went to war with Iran and destroyed the United States. I think the United States would face an absolute internal crisis if it went to war with Iran. We have not experienced the level of military response in a conflict that we would experience if we engaged with Iran for decades. If we got body bags sent back to the United States the way that we would if this terrible situation, if the Israelis had their way, played out, there would be internal strife in the United States that would maybe destabilize it to the point of no return. And so I think because of the situation with Gaza, because of the situation with Israel having, you know, the neocon doctrine, clean break document from back in the 90s, they've checked off all of their countries, their axis of evil. Iran is the last remaining one. It came to a point when Trump came into office that Israel thought, this is our chance. This is when we're going to make it happen. It's now or never. And Trump is faced with the choice between being possibly the most disastrous president of my lifetime or someone who stood up against it. And I think Trump's own nature is to want negotiation and to say, first of all, I'm the one in charge, not Bibi Netanyahu. And so I think the issue of finding out that his national security advisor, Mike Waltz, was secretly meeting behind his back with Netanyahu in order to make this war happen contributed to a sense that, for pride's sake, Trump can't continue down this path. And so even if I don't love what he's doing with the Saudis right now, I do think that it is a bit of a slap in the face to Israel. And so I think that's positive. And from what I see in consuming U.S. media, I do think the rift is real, because I see that the Trump surrogates are speaking out against Israel for the first time in a way that 10 years ago, 5 years ago, you could have never imagined an American politician saying. For example, Marjorie Taylor Greene, she's a representative in the Trump camp, very strong figure in Make America Great Again. She said the other day that the Americans are tired of being lied to and going to war for Israel. This is something amazing to hear from a Republican politician. Matt Gaetz, who Trump originally selected as his attorney general, also recently went on a podcast and said, it's a little strange if whether you're on the right or the left, if you make legitimate criticisms of the Israeli government, they call you anti-Semitic, and that you have to toe a certain line from both parties on Israel. For these truths to be said out loud to me suggests that, yes, this rift is real, and Americans cannot tolerate this anymore. For all of the money that they've put in, the Adelsons, the main Zionist donors,
right,
they can't compete with the fact that the grassroots base of Trump, the youth, are totally over with Israel. Even the evangelical Christians, the young ones, they don't support Israel in the same way that the older baby boomer generation does. Right now, polls say that over 60% of American Republicans do not want war with Iran. And 10 years ago, those people would have been more susceptible to propaganda, and they're not now. I don't think you can undo that. And so I'm hopeful. It's going to take a lot of work, and there's a lot of darkness that comes when you start to talk about the Israeli situation. Even the truth about the JFK files, for example, when Trump declassified some of those, we started to see Israel mentioned a lot more when it came to that plot. So that's what you're dealing with when you start to question the Israeli special relationship. But again, I think it's inevitable. We cannot continue to be this way. I mean, whether it's our speech rights at home being taken away on behalf of these this foreign government.
Yes, of course, we've seen their universities.
Mm-hmm. It's ridiculous. I mean, it's interesting to see Trump's base even complaining about, they said we wanted deportations, but not for this. We wanted, you know, to look at this crisis that we had of millions of people coming across the border and disappearing into the country. We weren't worried about university students writing op-eds about Israel while here on legitimate visas and green cards. It's exposing the level of control to a point that Americans have never really seen before. And in that way, once you rip the mask off and you see the ugly monster, people are going to want to put it down.
Right. And one could say, despite all the casualties in Gaza, taking into account the big picture, we could see that this entire thing is backfiring against Israel. But could we see a similar move, meaningful move, by the U.S. government regarding Gaza, trying to this blockade and a war there?
I think that we're unfortunately taking baby steps. At this point, we're dealing with rhetoric and just trying to stop the escalation of the situation with Iran. But of course, if Trump really wanted to make a deal, tomorrow he could say he's ending aid to Israel and force them to let aid across the border. But we're not there yet, unfortunately. I don't think the bravery or the situation isn't prepared for that level, and that's disappointing to me because, of course, it's nice to talk about all the theories of the changing world, but when there are people suffering at the level there is in Gaza, it's pretty hard to tolerate. And there's this feeling of helplessness that I've even struggled with personally since this war began.
All of us, I think. And as an investigative journalist, how do you pick your topics to work on?
Usually it comes from conversations with people, a source or someone that might have information, and they share it with me, and then I just go down a rabbit hole. Since I became a mother, I kind of had to slow down because the rabbit hole can be never-ending and it can kind of be all-consuming. So I'm more focused on a family these days. But usually it's, or if I have a question, if I notice something about the way that news is being presented on the mainstream, and I see something else through my international networks, you know, friends in Iran or elsewhere that are showing another side, then I kind of have to try and find the information to present. We say that the gray zone is trying to break the media blockade in the United States, that in the U.S. we just have one view presented. So sometimes they make that job pretty easy. For example, the way that they attack Iran is so extreme that it's pretty easy to tell the other side. All you have to do is show up here and show the reality of life. And sometimes something as simple as that can make a big difference in the United States because we are lied to so much. In Venezuela, too, we were told that there's no food, everybody's starving, everybody's killing each other and dying. All we had to do was go there and film the reality to make a big impact. Here they say, you know, that there are no religious minorities or that women are treated terribly. All we had to do was come here and film religious minorities and women walking in the street, or me walking in the street, to show that that's not the case. Sometimes it's more, it takes more of an effort to do an investigation, like I said, with documents, court documents, or sometimes focusing on an individual character. That's something I did a lot with my book, was taking the individuals who were leading the coup and going into their background deep. And then the story kind of emerges that they're all tools of the United States.
I see. That is very interesting. And of course, research is a huge part of your work as an investigative journalist. And mainstream media try to get you far and away from true material. How do you kind of make your way through and find them?
The internet has given us great resources, and for all the faults of X and the problems with it that are clear, it has also served as a great tool for connecting people around the world. traveling to places and meeting people, that to me is the greatest key. That's the greatest source of information, is people to people.
Anya, this is really interesting. We're going to talk about it some more, but after a quick break. Well, we're approaching the end of our program. Anya, I don't know, time really flies. I really did not realize the passing of time because I wanted to keep talking to you for hours. I really enjoyed this conversation. We are at the end of our show. We have about a minute. Take your time. Talk to the camera right behind me and straight to our audience.
Well, it has been such a pleasure and a privilege to come to Iran and to see the reality of people here. And I just hope that you understand that our government in the United States is not the same as the people. The people absolutely want peace. I think even now, many in our government want peace. And so that is what the message that I will take back to the United States from here is that there is no enemy in Iran. And we could actually be friends and live in a totally functional, happy world where everybody's having mutually beneficial arrangements and agreements. And the greatest obstacle to that is, unfortunately, my country and some foreign influence in my country that we are working to reveal. But I think that the inevitable human nature is that we're all going to find ourselves in a more sovereign, more politically independent, and happy world, because at the end of the day, I think we all want the same thing, which is a better life for our children. And so we're going to work to strive to make that happen in the United States. And I know that the brave Iranian people will do the same.
Thank you, Anya. It was a pleasure to talk to you here at SORP. I really wanted this conversation to go on, but we are at the end of the program. And thank you so much. This is the end of another SORP. But remember, SORP means only the beginning of the day. Until next time, it's goodbye from me, Bahman Urayi.
Engraved in his heart were the words of his mood to all. God's messenger.
Good day to all of our listeners. This is Iran Radio, and here are some interesting facts about Islam. During the Middle Ages, the Muslim world had numerous business advantages. They had a huge range of contacts, so they could trade everything from African gold to Chinese porcelain to European amber and furs. And Muslim craft workers were highly skilled, which meant their goods always found a really market. Without Muslim merchants, Europeans would have had no rice, sugar, or coffee. Approximately 5 to 8 million Muslims lived in the United States, and there are over 1,200 mosques. Muslims have been a part of the cultural landscape in America for the past 200 years. The Islamic Empire once stretched into modern-day Europe, particularly in Spain and the Balkans. Today, there are tens of millions of Muslims living in Europe. Now we'll listen to the continuation of our schedule on Iran Radio. We start off this hour's programs with our varied radio productions feature. Then it's time for Insights into the Holy Quran. The program presents a short exegesis or explanation of the ayahs of the Holy Quran. Our radio productions feature will again follow after this. And we round up this hour's programs with Ulama's speech. Stay with us for this hour.
Persian carpet has always received international praise, and that's because it's considered as the highest level of art, an artistic creation that has constantly improved and has become richer and more beautiful throughout the years.
The Persian carpet is a valuable piece of history. It's widely known for the beauty of its patterns, its intricately woven colors, durability, and the years of labor that went into making each rug. The value of a Persian carpet is determined by various factors, such as authenticity, quality of materials, fineness of the knots, and beauty of colors and design. The variety of carpets and rugs in Iran is enormous. Some are considered highly precious and valuable, while others are machine-made and not so expensive. The handmade rugs and carpets of the nomads have always been treasured in Iran. Their distinguishing features, especially their amazing level of quality, has made them very special. Nomadic rugs are woven by nomads or semi-settled tribes of people. They represent the simplest and earliest form of weaving. Almost all nomadic weavers employ horizontal and portable looms, unlike village and urban weavers who work on vertical looms. Rugs are generally woven to a pre-planned pattern, but rural rugs are based on designs that generate from the imagination of the weaver. They have ancient motifs that have been passed down families through the generations.
The Kheshti design is one of the oldest and most important designs.